Chapter 116. Containing matter of a surprising kind, as we gang our frolin and tomorrow meet, and as I didn't know that I was ever so happy in a my days, Mr. Nickleby, ding. But I will tack another glass to our next merry meeting. Apostrophe apostrophe, so said John Browdy, rubbing his hands with great joyousness, and looking round him with a ruddy shining face, quite in keeping with the declaration. The time at which John found himself in this enviable condition was the same evening to which the last chapter bore reference. The place was the cottage, and the assembled company were Nicholas, Mrs. Nickleby, Mrs. Browdy, Kate Nickleby, and Smike. A very merry party they had been. Mrs. Nickleby, knowing of her son's obligations to the honest Yorkshireman, had, after some demur, yielded her consent to Mr. and Mrs. Browdy being invited out to tea, in the way of which arrangement, there were at first sundry difficulties and obstacles, arising out of her not having had an opportunity of calling upon Mrs. Browdy first. For although Mrs. Nickleby very often observed with much complacency, as most punctilious people do, that she had not an atom of pride or formality about her, still she was a great stickler for dignity and ceremonies, and as it was manifest that, until a call had been made, she could not be, politely speaking, and according to the laws of society, even cognizant of the fact of Mrs. Browdy's existence, she felt her situation to be one of peculiar delicacy and difficulty. The call must originate with me, my dear, apostrophe said Mrs. Nickleby, that's indispensable. The fact is, my dear, that it's necessary there should be a sort of condescension on my part, and that I should show this young person that I am willing to take notice of her. There's a very respectable-looking young man, apostrophe added Mrs. Nickleby, after a short consideration, who is conductor to one of the omnibuses that go by here, and who wears a glazed hat. Your sister and I have noticed him very often. He has a wart upon his nose, Kate, you know, exactly like a gentleman's servant. Apostrophe, have all gentlemen servants warts upon their noses, mother? Apostrophe, apostrophe, asked Nicholas. Nicholas, my dear, how very absurd you are, apostrophe, returned his mother. Of course I mean that his glazed hat looks like a gentleman's servant, and not the wart upon his nose, though even that is not so ridiculous as it may seem to you, for we had a footboy once, who had not only a wart, but a wen also, and a very large wen too, and he demanded to have his wages raised in consequence, because he found it came very expensive. Let me see, what was I? Oh yes, I know. The best way that I can think of would be to send a card and my compliments. I've no doubt he'd take 'em for a pot of porter by this young man to the Saracen with Two Necks. If the waiter took him for a gentleman's servant, so much the better. Then all Mrs. Browdy would have to do would be to send her card back by the carrier. He could easily come with a double knock, and there's an end of it. Apostrophe, my dear mother, apostrophe said Nicholas, I don't suppose such unsophisticated people as these ever had a card of their own, or ever will have. Apostrophe, oh that, indeed, Nicholas, my dear, apostrophe returned Mrs. Nickleby, that's another thing. If you put it upon that ground, why, of course, I have no more to say than that I have no doubt they are very good sort of persons, and that I have no kind of objection to their coming here to tea if they like, and shall make a point of being very civil to them if they do. Apostrophe, the point being thus effectually set at rest, and Mrs. Nickleby duly placed in the patronizing and mildly condescending position which became her rank and matrimonial years, Mr. and Mrs. Browdy were invited and came, and as they were very deferential to Mrs. Nickleby, and seemed to have a becoming appreciation of her greatness, and were very much pleased with everything, the good lady had more than once given Kate to understand, in a whisper, that she thought they were the very best-meaning people she had ever seen, and perfectly well-behaved. And thus it came to pass that John Browdie declared, in the parlor after supper, to wit, and 20 minutes before 11 o'clock p.m., that he had never been so happy in all his days. Nor was Mrs. Browdie much behind her husband in this respect, for that young matron, whose rustic beauty contrasted very prettily with the more delicate loveliness of Kate, and without suffering by the contrast either, for each served as it were to set off and decorate the other, could not sufficiently admire the gentle and winning manners of the young lady, or the engaging affability of the elder one. Then Kate, at the art of turning the conversation to subjects upon which the country girl, bashful at first in strange company, could feel herself at home, and if Mrs. Nickleby was not quite so felicitous at times in the selection of topics of discourse, or if she did seem, as Mrs. Browdie expressed it, rather high in her notions, apostrophe still nothing could be kinder, and that she took considerable interest in the young couple was manifest from the very long lectures on housewifery with which she was so obliging as to entertain Mrs. Browdie's private ear, which were illustrated by various references to the domestic economy of the cottage, in which those duties falling exclusively upon Kate, the good lady had about as much share, either in theory or practice, as any one of the statues of the 12 apostles which embellish the exterior of St. Paul's Cathedral. Mr. Browdie, apostrophe said Kate, addressing his young wife, is the best-humored, the kindest and heartiest creature I ever saw. If I were oppressed with I don't know how many cares, it would make me happy only to look at him. Apostrophe, he does seem indeed, upon my word, a most excellent creature, Kate, apostrophe said Mrs. Nickleby, most excellent. And I am sure that at all times it will give me pleasure, really pleasure now to have you, Mrs. Browdie, to see me in this plain and homely manner. We make no display, apostrophe said Mrs. Nickleby, with an air which seemed to insinuate that they could make a vast deal if they were so disposed. No fuss, no preparation. I wouldn't allow it. I said, Kate, my dear, you will only make Mrs. Browdie feel uncomfortable, and how very foolish and inconsiderate that would be. Apostrophe, I am very much obliged to you, I am sure, ma'am, apostrophe returned Mrs. Browdie, gratefully. It's nearly 11 o'clock, John. I am afraid we are keeping you up very late, ma'am. Apostrophe, late. Apostrophe, apostrophe, cried Mrs. Nickleby, with a sharp thin laugh, and one little cough at the end, like a note of admiration expressed. This is quite early for us. We used to keep such hours. 12, 1, 2, 3 o'clock was nothing to us. Balls, dinners, card parties. Never were such rakes as the people about where we used to live. I often think now, I am sure, that how we ever could go through with it is quite astonishing, and that is just the evil of having a large connection, and being a great deal sought after, which I would recommend all young married people steadily to resist, though of course, and it's perfectly clear, and a very happy thing too, I think, that very few young married people can be exposed to such temptations. There was one family in particular that used to live about a mile from us, not straight down the road, but turning sharp off to the left by the turnpike, where the Plymouth mail ran over the donkey, that were quite extraordinary people for giving the most extravagant parties, with artificial flowers and champagne, and variegated lamps, and, in short, every delicacy of eating and drinking that the most singular epicure could possibly require. I don't think that there ever were such people as those Poltergeists. You remember the Poltergeists, Kate? Apostrophe, apostrophe, Kate saw that for the ease and comfort of the visitors it was high time to stay this flood of recollection, so answered that she entertained of the Poltergeists a most vivid and distinct remembrance, and then said that Mr. Browdie had half promised, early in the evening, that he would sing a Yorkshire song, and that she was most impatient that he should redeem his promise, because she was sure it would afford her mamma more amusement and pleasure than it was possible to express. Mrs. Nickleby confirming her daughter with the best possible grace, for there was patronage in that too, and a kind of implication that she had a discerning taste in such matters, and was something of a critic. John Browdie proceeded to consider the words of some North Country ditty, and to take his wife's recollection respecting the same. This done, he made divers ungainly movements in his chair, and singling out one particular fly on the ceiling from the other flies there asleep, fixed his eyes upon him, and began to roar a meek sentiment supposed to be uttered by a gentle swain fast pining away with love and despair, in a voice of thunder. At the end of the first verse, as though some person without had waited until then to make himself audible, was heard a loud and violent knocking at the street door, so loud and so violent, indeed, that the ladies started, as by one accord, and John Browdie stopped. "It must be some mistake," said Nicholas, carelessly. "We know nobody who would come here at this hour." Mrs. Nickleby surmised, however, that perhaps the counting house was burnt down, or perhaps the Mr. Cheerables had sent to take Nicholas into partnership, which certainly appeared highly probable at that time of night, or perhaps Mr. Linkinwater had run away with the property, or perhaps Miss La Creevy was taken in, or perhaps, but a hasty exclamation from Kate stopped her abruptly in her conjectures, and Ralph Nickleby walked into the room. "Stay," said Ralph, as Nicholas rose, and Kate, making her way towards him, threw herself upon his arm. "Before that boy says a word, hear me." Nicholas bit his lip, and shook his head in a threatening manner, but appeared for the moment unable to articulate a syllable. Kate clung closer to his arm, Smike retreated behind them, and John Browdie, who had heard of Ralph, and appeared to have no great difficulty in recognizing him, stepped between the old man and his young friend, as if with the intention of preventing either of them from advancing a step further. "Hear me, I say," said Ralph, "and not him." "Say what thou'st gotten to say then, sir," retorted John, "and tak care thou dinnot put up angry blood which thou'dst better try to quiet." "I should know you," said Ralph, "by your tongue, and him," pointing to Smike, "by his looks." "Don't speak to him," said Nicholas, recovering his voice. "I will not have it. I will not hear him. I do not know that man. I cannot breathe the air that he corrupts. His presence is an insult to my sister. It is shame to see him. I will not bear it." "Stand." cried John, laying his heavy hand upon his chest. "Then let him instantly retire," said Nicholas, struggling. "I am not going to lay hands upon him, but he shall withdraw. I will not have him here. John Browdie, is this my house? Am I a child? If he stands there," cried Nicholas, burning with fury, looking so calmly upon those who know his black and dastardly heart, "he'll drive me mad." To all these exclamations John Browdie answered not a word, but he retained his hold upon Nicholas, and when he was silent again, spoke. "There's more to say and hear than thou think'st for," said John. "I tell ye I ha' gotten sent o' thought already. What be that shadow outside door there? Noo, schoolmeester, show thyself, mun. Dinnot be shame feast. Noo, all gentlemen, let's have schoolmeester, coom." Hearing this adjuration, Mr. Squeers, who had been lingering in the passage until such time as it should be expedient for him to enter, and he could appear with effect, was fain to present himself in a somewhat undignified and sneaking way, at which John Browdie laughed with such keen and heartfelt delight, that even Kate, in all the pain, anxiety, and surprise of the scene, and though the tears were in her eyes, felt a disposition to join him. "Have you done enjoying yourself, sir?" said Ralph, at length. "Pratty nigh for the present time, sir," replied John. "I can wait," said Ralph. "Take your own time, pray." apostrophe, Ralph waited until there was a perfect silence, and then turning to Mrs. Nickleby, but directing an eager glance at Kate, as if more anxious to watch his effect upon her, said, "Now, ma'am, listen to me. I don't imagine that you were a party to a very fine tirade of words sent me by that boy of yours, because I don't believe that under his control you have the slightest will of your own, or that your advice, your opinion, your wants, your wishes, anything which in nature and reason or of what use is your great experience, ought to weigh with him, has the slightest influence or weight whatever, or is taken for a moment into account." Apostrophe, Mrs. Nickleby shook her head and sighed, as if there were a good deal in that, certainly. "For this reason," apostrophe resumed Ralph, "I address myself to you, ma'am. For this reason, partly, and partly because I do not wish to be disgraced by the acts of a vicious stripling whom I was obliged to disown, and who, afterwards, in his boyish majesty, feigns to to disown me, I present myself here tonight. I have another motive in coming. A motive of humanity. I come here," apostrophe said Ralph, looking round with a biting and triumphant smile, and gloating and dwelling upon the words, as if he were loath to lose the pleasure of saying them, "to restore a parent his child. Eh, sir," apostrophe he continued, bending eagerly forward, and addressing Nicholas, as he marked the change of his countenance, "to restore a parent his child, his son, sir, trepanned, waylaid, and guarded at every turn by you, with the base design of robbing him some day of any little wretched pittance, of which he might become possessed. Apostrophe, in that, you know you lie," apostrophe said Nicholas, proudly. "In this, I know I speak the truth. I have his father here," apostrophe retorted Ralph. "Here," apostrophe apostrophe sneered Squeers, stepping forward. "Do you hear that? Here. Didn't I tell you to be careful that his father didn't turn up and send him back to me? Why, his father's my friend. He's to come back to me directly, he is. Now, what do you say, eh? Now come, what do you say to that? Aren't you sorry you took so much trouble for nothing? Aren't you? Aren't you? Apostrophe, you bear upon your body certain marks I gave you," apostrophe said Nicholas, looking quietly away, "and may talk in acknowledgement of them as much as you please. You will talk a long time before you rub them out, Mr. Squeers." Apostrophe, the estimable gentleman last named cast a hasty look at the table, as if he were prompted by this retort to throw a jug or bottle at the head of Nicholas, but he was interrupted in this design, if such design he had, by Ralph, who, touching him on the elbow, bade him tell the father that he might now appear and claim his son. This being purely a labor of love, Mr. Squeers readily complied, and leaving the room for the purpose, almost immediately returned, supporting a sleek personage with an oily face, who, bursting from him, and giving to view the form and face of Mr. Snawley, made straight up to Smike, and tucking that poor fellow's head under his arm in a most uncouth and awkward embrace, elevated his broad Gutenberg edition. End of chapter.